Hello, I'm Norman Swan and this is the Health Report. In this program, knocking your white blood cells into shape and giving them back to you seems to be promising in both HIV infection and certain cancers. Plus, another in our occasional series where we hear from people who've encountered doctors and nurses and the healthcare system, found them wanting, and then done something about it. Their battle has been to get health professionals to use the evidence. A little while ago, we had climatologist Dr. Stephen Schneider on talking about his lymphoma and how he challenged his specialists to use more rational ways of making decisions. In this program, I want you to meet someone I met at a conference in Melbourne organised by the National Institute of Clinical Studies. The meeting aimed to find effective ways of putting evidence-based guidelines for health professionals into practice. Ellen Reed's husband had a rare condition called amyloidosis, which is where a muddy kind of material called amyloid builds up abnormally in organs and tissues around the body. Ellen's fight for an accurate diagnosis and the right treatment was turbulent, but worked in the end. She bravely agreed that I interview her in front of a large audience. By the way, you'll hear the word myeloma being used. That's a cancer of the bone marrow. So I want to introduce Ellen Reed to you. Ellen is a retired pharmacist who's lived in Western Australia, who's lived in London and now lives in Melbourne. And part of her journey through the world has been for medical reasons. Ellen is the founder of the amyloidosis support group in Australia. There wasn't one. How many people in this room have ever seen somebody with amyloidosis? So it's a handful.
Hello, Norman.
Hi, Ellen. Tell us when Jim, your husband, late husband, first noticed something wrong.
Oh, when we were married.
Nothing to do with the marriage, I hope.
1968, his skin was very sensitive and he couldn't bear me to hold hands with him like people normally do. And in bed we had problems. He didn't like pressure against him. He had an irritable bowel problem and he had back pain. So for 37 years, my husband had problems. He looked fantastic. And so the doctors never paid any attention to his problems.
He was a teacher?
He was a school teacher. He was a deputy principal, a very dedicated teacher, did remedial reading as an extra for the school. He worked for the YMCA. He was into voluntary work and he was continually caring about others, a bit to the neglect of the family. But
the grass didn't grow beneath his feet?
No. And we travelled a bit. And some of our travel was hampered by his health problems. He could never carry cases, so I had to do the work. But I was a pharmacist, and women pharmacists can do anything. Anyway, Jim gradually got weaker. It did affect our marriage because he was impotent, probably after about 5 years. We fortunately had a couple of children. But we always put his problems down to stress and we always hoped that when he retired, we would have our honeymoon. So.
And what did doctors say about him when he went to talk to him about it?
Well, one of them in England, actually, said to him, look, you'd have something to worry about if you have what I've got, and that was psoriasis. And it was
right.
At that stage.
Interesting clinical technique.
Because Jim had very sore feet. He couldn't stand pressure on his toes, so we had to buy socks from England. And they're very expensive, so it had a financial bearing on our family, a very hidden problem.
So when did it start getting worse?
In the 90s. He actually retired prematurely from teaching because he couldn't keep on. He couldn't stand. He had to have a stool because of his back pain. And the diarrhea, intermittent diarrhea, meant that he'd be in and out of the classroom. But the GPs even then, this is in Western Australia, wouldn't accept that he was medically unfit. So he retired from teaching on half pay because he couldn't get a clearance. So he was regarded as a hypochondriac.
It's all in his head.
All in the head, yes. Yep. So he retired. Our children were both on working holidays in London. And Jim was finding that he couldn't stand the heat in Western Australia. So the kids said, come to London. So we sold up and we moved to London.
And you hadn't heard of climate change.
Well, it was nice in London. Anyway, Jim fell through the NHS system.
he was getting progressively worse.
Yes, he couldn't climb stairs, and we lived upstairs in a flat. So it came to a stage in 99 that we had to sell up and come back to Australia. So we came to Victoria because it's cooler.
And there's still no diagnosis, no tests, nothing at that point?
Nothing, no. He'd have x-rays now and then. He'd been to a neurologist who was told, well, there's something funny about your feet, but that's it. He had a carpal tunnel problem, which is a classic with amyloidosis. He had night sweats, quite drenching night sweats. And no one ever thought to do a good range of blood tests on him. He had the x-rays that showed that he had a bit of a compression problem of a disc, and that's what all of that was, his pain was blamed on. He was on 8 Panadeine Forte a day.
Eight,
yes, maximum dose.
That would have fixed up his diarrhoea.
Well, it did and it didn't, because it gave him constipation, and then he'd have to have laxatives. It was one long saga. Yes.
So what was the first attempt at diagnosis? Where did you end up?
We finished up here. He was having physiotherapy and he developed a tremor. And the physiotherapist said to me, look, I wonder if he's got Parkinson's or motor neurone disease, because he'd got to a stage he couldn't walk 100 yards. He was sleeping continually. He'd have breakfast and then a nap and then morning tea and another nap. And he could sleep 20 hours a day. And he'd be going to the GP on his own, because I always respected his region. That was his own personal place. And it got to a stage I thought, that GP is just not listening. So I sat in on it and I said to the GP, do you realise he sleeps about 20 hours a day? He's lost kilos in weight without deliberately trying to. And his GP said, oh, you know, well, maybe I should send him to a rheumatologist. And I said, well, I think it's a neurological problem. Can he have a referral? So it took months for a referral to the rheumatologist, because he flatly refused to believe it was neurological. When we got to the rheumatologist, Jim was so weak he couldn't climb on the examining bench. And I said to him, look, I'm sure it's neurological. So he actually called in a neurologist on the spot, and they agreed on a bank of tests, and I heard them saying hospital. So the neurologist fitted Jim in a couple of days later, and he was admitted to hospital and spent 6 weeks there while they tried to diagnose the problem. And they came up with AL amyloidosis, because he had a mediastinal lymph node that was 5 centimetres long and completely replaced with amyloid. And he had amyloid in a duodenal ulcer. He had a paraprotein in his urine.
And they thought it was due to myeloma.
They decided, I've got the papers that says we assume it's a myeloma, because that's the main cause of amyloidosis. But because of FOI, I obtained his other records and found that the bone marrow biopsy said query myeloma, query lymphoma, and also a CT scan said this. So I did reading. My kids have made me quite computer literate. And I found that really these symptoms fitted a B-cell lymphoma more than a myeloma.
So how did the haematologist receive this information?
No. Each time, for 2 years, I kept saying, could it be a lymphoma? And each time they'd say, no, because... And I'd just have to pull my head in and watch Jim getting progressively sicker. Very little is known about amyloidosis in this country. We haven't got any one clinician who could be called an expert. There are a couple of good ones, one in Brisbane, one in Adelaide, and the rest of them see so few patients, because the incidence only... 8 in 1 million, so about 200 new patients a year.
And you found that despite having got the runaround in the NHS has a National Amyloidosis Centre.
They've got a wonderful centre where patients, once they're diagnosed, are referred to London, where they can have a complete workout.
And they have guidelines.
And they produce guidelines. That's why I'm here.
So how was it received when you turned up on the ward with the UK national guidelines on the treatment of amyloidosis?
A bit of reservation. But fortunately, I do have enough medical knowledge, and I had to have a crash course in haematology and everything, didn't I? And I was also told that when you have a patient with a rare disease, the carer has to become assertive. And 35 years as a pharmacist checking up on doctors, keeping an eye on their prescribing mistakes, made it a little bit easier for me than probably for a lot of other patients, carers.
But tell us of that moment where you walked in with a piece of paper.
They didn't want to know, really, but I had got to a stage, as far as I was concerned, I wanted the best treatment in the world possible in Australia for my husband.
And he was looking at not very much more time to live.
Oh, no. Well, the prognosis to start off with is 11 months, and he'd already outlived that. He'd been through two different types of chemotherapy, and he wasn't suitable for a stem cell harvest. So he was dying. I had nothing to lose. I also wanted it that if he did have the lymphoma, if I wanted to sue the hospital with these guidelines and the other data I was giving them, the medical staff couldn't plead ignorance. So I gave these guidelines to every doctor and paramedical professional that I came near, or that came near my husband. So
decreasingly fewer, I imagine.
I must have given out 40 or 50 copies of these. We have a website, and there's the link to these guidelines on the website. We produce a CD, which has got 860 articles about amyloidosis on it, and which also has the guidelines. And I promote these guidelines everywhere because they helped save my husband's life.
So it did change. So giving them the guidelines did change their behaviour.
Yes, yes, it did make them more respectful. It gave them information, because what GP, what gastroenterologist, what neurologist is going to look in the British Journal of Haematology for information on amyloidosis?
And this pushed them to check for B cell lymphoma.
No, well, this didn't. It was our continual daily search of the internet, and eventually the lymphoma article came up. So that was six cases at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital where they'd had a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma causing AL amyloidosis. So that gives you an incidence of something like one in a billion, and we demanded that they retest. And because we found that article, and because we'd been pushing for quality care, we were believed, and that was followed through.
And the treatment of his lymphoma transformed him for a while, at least.
It did, yes. He had another year of life. He finished up off all painkillers. The neurologist couldn't believe it. He walked a kilometre. He didn't need his wheelchair for 6 months. And we actually made love again. And that rounded our life out because of finding the correct information.
What's happened since? You've started this.
Well, Jim died in March last year because he had a relapse of the lymphoma. And he was riddled with amyloid. We allowed them to do a post-mortem, and they were amazed at just how much amyloid there was. And after he died, we thought the last thing we wanted to hear about was amyloidosis again. And then we thought, well, all these other patients in Australia who haven't got a national amyloidosis centre, who've got nothing really as far as the internet was concerned, they had to go internationally. So the family decided we'd start a charity, and my daughter Jean created a wonderful website. We hear from new patients every week.
And is there any evidence that the guidelines are being applied, do you think?
Oh, I'm sure they are, yes. We send these to every new patient. They are simple to read. They're a very good quality guideline, from what I gather. They were produced in conjunction with the Myeloma Foundation in London and the government and the Amyloid Centre. There's a new set due next year. They cost them £20,000. That was the donation from the Myeloma Foundation. And it took them 2 years to do the work, to do the research. I believe that they are a very comprehensive set of guidelines.
Recently on the Health Report, I ran a series on evidence-based medicine, and the second part of that series was taking the view that consumers drive change and change in health behaviour. And I can't tell you the number of emails and letters I've had from doctors in particular saying that's rubbish, never seen it happen. What's your response to that notion that consumers drive change in health practitioners' behaviour?
Well, I had it this week. On Monday, I was contacted by a haematologist from a private hospital here who asked me if I would contact one of his patients because she couldn't understand the need for chemotherapy. And I was able to ring her, she's in the country, and tell her the ins and outs. Also, because of my knowledge of amyloidosis, I was able to pick up her problems with her neuropathy and her marital problems, because nearly all of them are impotent. And this woman and her husband had been having long-term problems. And they were able to talk it over that night, and it's transformed their life, and she's going to have the chemotherapy.
Absolutely, an enormous help to individuals.
Yes.
But my question was really slightly different, because that's a haematologist who was already on your side.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't?
No. That's another amazing thing, because a year ago I was asked to accompany a patient to see this doctor, and his immediate reaction, they were Italians, they were very worried about communicating. And when this haematologist saw me there, you know, oh, what on earth is she doing here? And he really didn't want to discuss them in front of me. So this doctor has changed his tune because he can see the need for an advocate for patients. I think that's part of it.
Please join me in thanking Ellen Reed.
I spoke to Ellen Reed at a recent conference held by the National Institute of Clinical Studies in Melbourne. Ellen's organisation is called Amyloidosis Australia, and the website is amyloidosisaustralia.org. And we'll have a link to it from the Health Report, which is the programme you're listening to here on ABC Radio National. Now, you heard Ellen say that the specialist thought her husband, Jim, had myeloma. That's a cancer of specific cells in the bone marrow. The problems associated with myeloma include pain, fatigue, increased risk of fractures, and susceptibility to infections. The treatment of myeloma has improved over the years, but one of the mainstays is still bone marrow transplantation, which is really a way of rescuing the person's immune system after undergoing very high-dose chemotherapy in an attempt to wipe out the myeloma. A research group at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia is trying to make this safer and perhaps even more effective at fighting the cancer itself. They're doing this by manipulating the person with myeloma's T cells before they have the treatment. Bruce Levine is Associate Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, a T cell is one of the white cells that are circulating in your blood and part of your immune system. We explain them as the quarterback of the immune system, and they coordinate the response to foreign substances in your body.
Now, let's just describe the problem that you were trying to solve.
Well, there are two problems, really. One problem is that a common treatment for multiple myeloma is a stem cell transplant.
Bone marrow transplant.
Exactly. Now, that treatment, the stem cell or bone marrow transplant, a side effect of it is you're giving back an immature immune system, and you don't have all the components of a healthy immune system right after the stem cell transplant.
And not only that, the myeloma itself knocks off your immune system and you can get serious pneumonia and so on.
That is the second problem with a lot of cancers, is that they in themselves suppress or inhibit a normal immune response. So if we can get the T cells, that quarterback of the immune system, out of the environment of the tumor or the myeloma and re-educate those cells in the laboratory and then infuse them, we think we can have an improved immune system.
So what you did first off was take one of the commonest complicating infections, which is pneumococcus, causing serious pneumonia.
Exactly. And there is an approved vaccine for a pneumococcus, and we gave it to people. And then we collected those cells, stored them in the freezer until after they had gotten their bone marrow transplant. And then we got them out of the freezer, grew them up in the lab, manipulated them, and then reinfused those educated T cells back into the patients.
So in other words, where the stored memory was, you kind of kept the memory almost like in a hard disk, but this was in a test tube in the lab. And then when the hard disk had been wiped, in a sense, in the bone marrow transplant, you then put the memory back in.
You've got that exactly. It's maintaining the memory while you give the very intensive chemotherapy and the stem cell transplant, and giving back those memory T cells early, just at the time that people are susceptible to the pneumococcal infection. And this can work for other infections as well.
How do you know you're not giving back the cancer?
What we do is test for residual tumor cells in the lab.
And the reason for giving these T cells is that if you just were to re-immunize these people, their immune system just isn't up to recognizing it.
That's right. In fact, it's not recommended to immunize people with live vaccines for a year or two after a bone marrow transplant. People's immune systems, when they get a bone marrow transplant, just don't respond because it takes these T cells a long time to mature from the bone marrow.
So what were the results of the trial?
We had four arms of the trial where we gave the vaccine at different schedules and giving the T cells in different schedules. And it turns out that if you prime those memory T cells with the vaccine before collecting them and before the stem cell transplant, and then give those back early, we can reconstitute memory to pneumococcus much, much earlier than anyone has found previously, as well as reconstituting other immune memory to other infections that are a problem after bone marrow transplant.
So in other words, you had a side effect that these T cells held memory for other diseases too?
Yes. So one of the other common problems post-bone marrow transplant is cytomegalovirus. And cytomegalovirus, there's a lot of illness and some mortality after a bone marrow transplant. So we looked at the response to cytomegalovirus as well as the response to the pneumococcal vaccine and found that we could accelerate the memory response reconstitution in the patients after giving the T cells.
These people having the transplant have had all sorts of diseases throughout their lives and had all sorts of immunizations. Do these T cells carry the whole menu that they've had throughout their lives?
Some of that may be gone if it's a person that's a little bit older, or it may not be as frequent as someone who has had a recent infection.
And no one who'd had this T-cell reinfusion developed a pneumococcal infection. But Bruce Levine and his colleagues had another motive for doing this pre-transplant immunization, because their ultimate goal is a cancer vaccine. In other words, provoking the immune system to attack the remaining myeloma cells in the bone marrow in the hope of ridding the person entirely of this disease. So by providing trained T cells, even if it was just to pneumococcus, they hope to generate an anti-cancer effect as well. Now they're currently trying to encourage this response further by immunizing the T cells to part of the myeloma as well as the pneumococcus.
It's taking them out of the bad environment or taking them out of the bad neighborhood that is the tumor. And once we do that in the lab and re-educate them and then infuse them, we think we have a better chance to fight off the tumor.
What evidence have you got, say, in animals that that process actually works?
Well, we have a few experiments in animals, not in cancer, but in HIV, looking at reconstituting the immune system in monkeys with a type of HIV called SIV. And what we're seeing is a reconstitution very similar to what we have subsequently observed in people. We have clinical trials going on in HIV separately from our cancer trials, using the similar approach of re-educating the T cells to reconstitute the immune system. In cancer, the problem is twofold. It's accelerating the reconstitution of your T cells, maintaining that T cell memory, as well as fighting off the residual cancer. In HIV, the problem is fighting off HIV or virally infected T cells, and also bringing up the level of immune response to where it was before the HIV had destroyed the immune system.
How are you using it in HIV?
Well, in HIV, the patients don't get any chemotherapy, at least in the approaches we're trying right now. And we take their T cells and we expand them up in the laboratory and then infuse greater numbers of those T cells afterwards.
What sort of results are you getting in HIV?
What we have found is that we're able to reset the CD4 count and the CD4-CD8 ratio in people to whom we infuse multiple doses of re-engineered T cells.
And just to explain, the CD4 are T cells which are actually very low in HIV.
Yeah, so there's two main flavors of T-cells, CD4s and CD8s. CD4s are the helpers, CD8s are the killers, and the CD4s are the T-cells that are infected in HIV.
Now, on the Health Report, I often tell you about leading-edge research like this, and it's easy to talk about, but what's mind-boggling is the laboratory investment required to make it happen. Bruce Levine took me on a quick tour.
Yeah, so this is a clean room, and we have all the air filtered, and we have cleanable surfaces. So the floor doesn't have any seams, the wall is a special paint, and the ceiling is cleanable in order to keep the risk of contaminating the cell product down. You're in this room now. This is a typical room where we process the T-cell vaccines, and it's got a clean cabinet called a laminar flow hood. It's got a centrifuge for spinning down cells, an incubator for growing the cells, and we have some larger equipment around the corner to do cell separation and cell washing. This is an instrument that we use for doing cell separations. It's basically a magnet with some places for tubing and bags to go, and there's software that runs a cell separation program.
What does the magnet do?
The way that we can separate the cells is we have tiny magnetic particles to which are conjugated proteins that bind different types of cells. And when we coat the cells with those magnetic particles and we run them through a magnetic column, we can either select for or select against the cells that we're interested in. And what we've got over here is a couple instruments that help us count the cells. This is a new type of bioreactor we're looking at.
Looks like a baby's bed rocking with a bag of water on it.
Yeah, there is a bag that is semi-inflated with culture media inside, and it's rocking back and forth on a heated platform. This is one of the magnets that we use to remove the beads before we infuse the cells into patients, and it's quite large and heavy, so you wouldn't want to put your credit card on there. We're here in front of three cell washing machines.
And they literally look like top-loading washing machines.
Yeah, they are. And we use these machines to concentrate and wash the cells.
So it really is a fairly significant industrial process.
Exactly, and we haven't even gotten to the gene therapy aspect of things. We have a machine down the end of the hall that can basically electrocute cells to make holes in their cell membranes to get genes in. We have viruses that we can use to deliver potentially therapeutic genes, and then there's a whole set of additional quality control testing that we have to do for a gene transfer.
And that's just one patient at a time. Imagine if it works, and you're going to have to do it for tens of thousands of people around the world. Just imagine the facility you're going to need for that. Scale up, they call it. Bruce Levine runs the Clinical Cell and Vaccine Production Facility at the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. I'm Norman Swan, and you've been listening to The Health Report. I'll see you next time.